Welcome to the second week of virtual machine teaching and lecturing. So last week, I must apologize, I was on a conference in Marseille, which was nice because it was warm, and Marseille is a nice city. But I guess, Stefan explained things well. And by that, in this way, you have kind of made yourself friends, because he will kind of be in charge of the tutorials and practical exercises accompanying this lecture. So I guess he told me he arrived at the switch statement already. So that is, he gave us you an overview over principles of what is the essence of virtual machines, why virtual machines, then started with a specific one, namely the virtual machine for C. And I guess he also told you that from a practical perspective, C is not so, in some sense, it's kind of a joke that there is a virtual machine for C. Why? Because for some people consider C as kind of a high-level assembly language, which is portable from one hardware to another, and allows you to, in a very detailed way, communicate with the computer and kind of have more or less direct access to the hardware. So then virtualizing C kind of would give away this big advantage of the programming language. So in that sense, it is in the other way around. Various compilers translate other programming languages into C, and then hope that there are decent C compilers around to do the final step to bring the code onto the hardware. But the reason is why we still do this virtual machine on C for C is twofold. First, it allows us to explain details of the semantics of C, which otherwise kind of get easily be swept under the carpet. And on the other hand, it allows us to explain the translation, how to translate any imperative language into some virtual machine. And so for that purpose, we could use also, we might have used Pascal, for example, or Modula, or Java even, but these are more complicated languages in some sense, and not so popular or practical languages, and therefore we decided to stay to use the C as a good compromise. First, to explain how to translate imperative programming constructs to a virtual machine, and on the other hand, learn insights into a realistic language. Okay, so but we agree to start at 10, or so that if you come so late, should we better start at 10:15? We said. Franz Hassmann communicated to me that it were 10. So if it is 10:15, so then this communication flow of communication did not work properly. Sorry for that. So it is 10:15. Was that the decision for both days on Monday and on Tuesday? Or did you do no decision for the Tuesday? And what is the decision for Tuesday then? Because Tuesday is tomorrow. 10 or 10:15? 10:15. Okay, so then I'm sorry that I was a little bit unfriendly for the moment. It was my fault. I didn't know. So then the question is whether we should wait until the others arrive or whether we should simply continue. Are many missing? You know of many who are missing? Hmm? It was pretty full. So then perhaps I stop all that explanation and discussion, or we may discuss things, but I will not speak about anything serious anymore. And we start again at 10:15. By the way, what was the last slide? Was it this one, or did he kind of already arrive at that one? You have not seen that? Okay, so then I simply started the speech segment. So one not so serious question: how many of you study BWL? So economics? No, no one. How many of you are not native German speakers? Oh, that's the majority. How many of those not native German speakers are meanwhile German speakers? No one. Are you attending German courses? Because this I would recommend, even if we do our lecturing in English. I guess it's a great opportunity if you are in a foreign country to learn about the language. Because as you notice, we all try our best to provide some kind of English, but it's some kind of English, and so you can clearly not improve your English by attending our lectures. But you can improve your German by attending Everyday's Life, I guess. Okay, so then now again a fresh welcome to this lecture. So I guess now it's time, and hopefully now we are complete. So Stefan provided you already with insights into some basics of the translation from C to the virtual machine designed for C, and so I guess he already considered how to translate expressions, how to evaluate how to translate expressions into sequences of instructions, which provide code which is meant to evaluate, which to determine the value of these expressions, and also showed you how to generate code for simple control structures. So what are simple control structures? So there is if then else is, so no then, but at least so conditional branching, and also for simple forms of loops. And now there are more control statements, and one particular interesting one is the switch statement. So what is the idea of the switch statement? Well, this is the situation when you want to branch not between two alternatives but between a finite set of alternatives. So that means, for example, you want to do a case distinction on characters, for example, and for different characters you want to do different things. So for example, you have a decoder or something, or a scanner which reads some input file and wants to kind of do something with construct an internal representation. So it has to do a different thing for different bytes and or different characters. And so now what can you do? So you with if then else you would have to do to construct long trees or deep trees and complicated trees of distinctions by splitting the universe of alternatives into suitable portions, and in the end, so it's a nasty thing to program. So it's a better way if you had a construct which allows you in one go to list all the cases, and then let the compiler somehow figure out how to access the matching case as quickly as possible. Yeah, and so if the cases were just distinguished by means of numbers, so for example, you have that the switch statement switches on an int, so that's perhaps the most popular case. So if it switches on an int, and so in C it will always switch on some kind of number, then you could then the idea would be kind of I would say, or advertises itself, so that you might use this int to compute somehow directly the alternative which to select, not to do kind of jumping around and doing another check and another check and another check, but just take the number and then directly use it to compute the address of the alternative. Now, how can that be done? So in the current instructions which we have provided so far for the C machine are not able to do so. So what one would need somehow is a kind of table where all the start addresses of the alternatives are stored in, and then one could kind of, if one has the starting address of this table, then one could kind of use the number of the case kind of to as an index. But that means that the address where to jump to would somehow be constructed by taking a base address and adding a value which is on top of the stack, and then use that as as the address to be jumped to, and that is we might call this an indexed jump. So here is a picture, an index jump. So here's a picture how such an index jump might be calculated. So assume that you have some start address where the table of the jump table begins. This is the queue. You have that on top of the stack. No, sorry. You know where the jump table lies. This is this B here. And you have some computed value. This is this Q. And this computed value, Q, is on top of the stack. And then you use these two to determine the real address to jump to by kind of putting B plus Q into the PC. And this kind of instruction is again one of these instructions which consumes its, which has an argument. This is the Q, a runtime argument, which is the Q. And according to our convention, arguments which are arguments to instructions are provided on the stack and consumed, that is, removed from the stack by the instruction. And that means afterwards the Q is popped from the stack. Okay? So that would be the instruction. And now the new instruction which we add to our set, and that we would now like to employ to translate switch statements. So now we might briefly recap how the syntax and of a switch statement in C is, and then we notice that the switch statement in C can be very general. And this form of a switch statement, which I show you here, is kind of a, if you like, a simplified and the cleanest switch statement one might conceive. So you see what is the property of this cleaned up switch statement. Okay, here you have the expression on which to do the case distinction. Then you have here an enumeration of cases, and the cases are enumerated from 0 to some k minus 1, and then follows a default a default case. For what is the default case? Non-matching cases, thank you. And then there's another thing which I have added. After every case, there is a sequence of statements, and that is kind of terminated by a break. So I'm now at these breaks, for example, I mark in red. Why?
To execute one.
So why do I have put them in red? Because they are optional, so you can kind of leave them out. So what happens if you don't leave, if you leave them out? Yes, that simply means that if case zero applies, the sequence of statements SS0 is executed, and then evaluation simply continues with the statement sequence SS1. So it simply is it falls through and just and not falls through, but just continues with the next sequence in the line. And so in that sense, these breaks make things cleaner in that they clearly distinguish the code of the different cases, but in reality they are optional. And there's even there are two more general the switch statements in C are more general even in two respects. In which respects? So first, these cases are more or less kind of labels. They can be put anywhere in the code and not only on the top level. So that's one extra. Whether it makes always sense is a different story, but you can put them anywhere. So that's one thing. And the other thing is it's by no means necessary that the cases start with zero and end with some number, but they could be in any order, any subset of values. And there could be, for example, 0, minus 20, minus 50, minus plus 1 million, and no other cases, and then the default. Yeah, so this also makes life a little bit more complicated, or at least gives poses some challenge onto the compiler writer. So here it is. So once again, it's a simple case, but we would like to attack that simple case first, and then kind of think how we can extend it in some form. Okay? So here is how we would like to do it, and we kind of follow the same idea as probably Stefan also applied when translating other programming language constructs. So you have some source level code, and somehow for each of the, it's a complicated construct, but it is recursively built out of other program components. So you somehow then create code for all these components, you concatenate it, and you put some extra stuff around. So this means here we have the constituents E. Now I make it in green, this gives better color. E. So SS0, SS1, and so on, all these sequences. And for all of them, we somehow have to generate code, and we have to place the code sequences for that somehow into the resulting program, and that we do. And then we perhaps have to put something around, some more logic, some more code around to kind of realize the logic of the flow in the program. So this means here we have to evaluate E, so we have to place the code for evaluating E somewhere. So and that's the first task which we have to do, so we place it at the beginning. So and please note that this is code R. What is code R? It computes, this is a sequence of codes, so when executed it computes the value of the, not the address, but the value of the expression. Very good. That is the thing which we need here. And then we have to do something with it. I don't know yet what. But then later, we need the code, again, let us do it in green. We need the code for all the alternatives, including the default. And then, after the code for all these alternatives, we have the breaks. And the breaks mean somehow, okay, I'm done with the switch statement, I jump to the end. So the end has the address D, and so there must be always a jump D. Okay? So that's it. And then I have one more thing. All of these, perhaps also in yellow. No, now it's green, red. All of them have start addresses. So that's kind of just, this is kind of routine. Now we have to realize the logic around it. Okay, and so we said, aha. So our idea was we try to select the alternative by means of an index jump. So that that means somewhere we have to collect the jump table. So that is the jump table. Now let me write in red that is this one. So this consists of a sequence of jumps and jumps to the beginning of the alternatives. Yeah? And that table also has a start address which I know. This is B. Okay? And that means, And so now we have virtually everything in that in explained, and there's only one thing left, and that's now crucial, namely here. So what do we do with the value which we have computed, which at runtime we have computed for the expression E? So when, as soon as expression E is evaluated, that value is on top of the stack. That's our invariant. Now, so this now this blue thing now must be a sequence of instructions which takes this value and uses it to jump to the corresponding entry in the jump table starting at B. So that's the simple thing. And the, actually, what we would like to have is that this check, I call it a macro because it turns out to be in the end a quite longish sequence of instructions. But ideally, it simply should be a jump, an index jump B. Yeah, because then the B we know is the start, and then we add the Q, and then that's it. Yeah, so that would be the our dream, that we use just jump B instead of this check. Now the question is, why does that is that not enough? And the reason is that we have to do it's if all the values which could be produced by the evaluation of the expression were in the range from 0 to k, then this would be fine. Yeah, because then we would never jump outside the jump table. But we must avoid that we jump somewhere in the code, because that would be kind of make our code extremely vulnerable. You could kind of jump anywhere. You just let the expression evaluate some weird value, and then you will jump anywhere in your code. That's incredible. So we must catch all these bad and ugly cases. And that is, we have to check that the value is in the interval 0 to k, and then we can use it as an index. Or if it is less or greater. If it is less or greater, what do we do then? We go to the default. But so we have to detect these cases. And so that is a lot of... So in principle, this is no complicated thing. You know, you have to check this and that and that and that, and then you do this and that and that. So it's all not very complicated, but you have to implement it simply. And now we have to implement it, and so it's a kind of a little bit of assembly language hacking, if you like, to provide that functionality. And here is this little hack. So you see, it's not so long, but at least it's at least I was not able to do it with less than 12 instructions. So, and in particular, I needed a new instruction, and that is interesting because the limit, and that's now and that is also a reason why I made this check thing a macro. In a real virtual machine, if you have such a complicated thing and the evaluation is so complicated, you may use some other way to compute that to provide that functionality. You make it a part of the functionality of the virtual machine. So the virtual machine can implement more efficiently than just using virtual machine instructions. It can use registers and all that other stuff which you have in your hardware, because the virtual machine implementation itself is on the real hardware, and there you know everything what you have, and you can be extremely efficient. So this is only, in that sense, this macro which I provide you here is kind of the fallback thing. If you if your virtual machine is completely ignorant of the hardware and has only the virtual machine instructions to do its job. So what is the problem here? The problem here is, and that is, I make again, I highlight already in red, is this instruction dub. This dub stands for duplication, and that means what is the problem? As soon as we as an instruction, for example, as we assume we have computed a value on top of the stack, and we check whether it is greater than 0 or equal to 0. If we jump at 0, for example, then we consume that value, and then it's gone, which is bad, because we have to do several checks on the same value. So therefore, we kind of have to keep one when we know we need the value several times. We kind of one way to deal with that is to duplicate it first, and then use the working copy to be consumed, and then we still have a copy which we can use for indexing or whatnot. Yeah. So therefore there is this dub instruction, and here is how this dub instruction works. It simply duplicates the value on top of the stack. Yeah? Okay, so now we have understood these dub instructions, and now let us see what we have to do. So the first piece of code, this one here, checks whether the value on top of the stack, so what which we have computed by evaluating E, whether it is greater or equal to zero. And that is how do we do it. We load the constant zero, and we check, compare the two values by means of this greater or equal operator, which we had. This returns zero if this is not the case. And if it's not the case, then it's less than zero, and then we jump to A. And A is the default case. Yeah? So that is kind of what we keep in mind. A is always the default case, so therefore I make it black. Yeah? Okay. So now if it's not the default case, then we go on. So that means it is greater or equal to zero. Okay, so then we have to check whether it is less or equal to K. Okay? So that is we load, we again duplicate, because it's another test which we have to perform. We load the constant K. We check for less or equal. For less than. And if it's less than K, then it's fine, because then it's in the, these are the regular cases. Otherwise, we are in the default case, and that is, if this is not the case, then we again have this fabulous jump at zero here will jump to again to the default case A. Now we have all excluded all cases where the default must be jumped at. So we are in the regular, we have the regular cases, and that is now we can use our fabulous index jump to jump to the right alternative. Okay, and you see now that after that we have the value is really consumed and it is gone. Okay, and now for the default thing, then we don't need. How do we do it? We then pop the value, which is there's still now a stupid value on top of the stack, which we cannot use for which we might not be able to use for indexing. So we pop that value. This is here. Replace it and push instead the address of the default, which is the kth entry of the kth entry of the jump table, and then also make an indexed jump there. We could in this place also, instead of loading K and then make an indexed jump to that, we could also directly jump to the kth alternative, to the address of the, make a direct jump to the to the default alternative, that is to the CK, but I did not do that because by that this macro is kind of independent of the application, and you can use it for this switch statement and for that switch statement. It's independent, and it is, has nothing. It is universally applicable. Okay? Yes, please. In C, you cannot make a switch on strings. So there you can't do it. And otherwise, if you want to do a switch on anything, what would you do? So maybe I just may ask, what would you do? Well, if you kind of, how can you do the same if you have a list? Because then you have to traverse the list somehow.
About using enumerations?
What do you mean?
We have an enumeration list.
What is an enumeration list?
During the pre-processing, the macros that are used to have enumeration, they are basically strings mapped against integers. So in the pre-processing, the preprocessor replaces them with integers.
Yes, but then you have some. You can do it. So you could think of, okay, in the cases are strings. So assume that the programming language allows it. Then the preprocessor may kind of assign integers to these strings. Fine, but the string to be compared with these other strings is a runtime value, and that cannot be handled by the preprocessor or by the compiler. So what we need here, or at least my suggestion would in that case be that, and we later will use that, we'll see that such things are used, for example, in languages like Prolog, that you simply have a hash table. You have a hash table, and that kind of mapping, in this case the strings, if it were strings, to the start addresses of the corresponding alternative. And then why is a hash table good? Because a hash table, then it allows very quickly, you take your string, compute the hash, apply the hash function to it, you get a number, you look up that number, you check whether this is really your string, it typically will be, and then you find the address where to jump to. So that's very fast. That one would do. Well, it is a switch implemented by means of a hash table. Because that you could also do in that case where you have large scattered numbers. Here we have an array of alternatives. If the array is very sparse, so what can you do? So there are many ways how to do it. So you identify dense portions in it and make many tables or so, but it's very nasty. One way to deal with it is simply throw them into knowing that it is, you have 10 cases, because that you see, it's widely scattered. You come up with some sort of hash function, and you can even determine this hash function. You can spend a lot of time to construct the hash function, because it's the compiler who comes up with the hash function. And that hash function is made in such a way that essentially you apply it and you get the value. That's it. Yeah? Okay? Once again? What do you mean it is done anyway? What is done anyway? Nothing is done anyway. But we have to implement the semantics of the language. And the semantics of the language is that if it's a case which is not listed, that you go to the default and not jump anywhere. So therefore the compiler has to make sure that this is the case. You cannot simply ignore that case. Was that your question? What was your question? Where is an address valid? I just have to find the right alternative, and there's no way around. And I expect the compiler to do this for me, and not only sometimes, but always. because if the compiler has a bug, that's kind of the super GAU for the poor programmer. Because he thinks always, he looks at his program, what did I wrong? What did I wrong? And if the program looks nice and correct and still the system crashes, then this is a devastating experience. So the compiler must be correct. Okay. Several kinds of design decisions which one can do. And when I show you this way to translate a switch statement, then this is not that. Then I'm not by that. I do not want to tell you that this is the only way, but this is one way. And what you should learn in this lecture is not. You should also learn how particular programming languages can be translated, but you should be should get enough overview to also negotiate. I would change it in this way or that way, and if I were the designer, I would make it completely different. Yeah, and only to see, so that is that should be the take home. And therefore, we should also here kind of wonder whether things which I write here so quickly, whether they really must be like that. So, for example, so here, if you see the organization of that code, what can be, what modifications were possible? So, one thing, for example, is that we have this jump table here at the end. So now you may ask, why should it be at the end? It could also be before. What advantage would it have if it were not after the alternatives, but before the alternatives? If it were before the alternatives, then the default could directly continue and need not jump across the jump table. Yeah. So that would be an argument for having the jump table immediately after, so here at that place, for example. So that were a good place. So why did I do it in this way? Or could there an argument to put it at the end? I think there's an historical argument for it, but one might, it's negotiable whether one would like to have it there or there. So one thing is that, at that point here, I have not yet seen the alternatives. And if I have a compiler which wants to be very fast and wants to do very much in the first pass over the code, it cannot produce this table because it has not seen the alternatives. It does not even know how many alternatives are there. So it does not know how much space it must keep open. And only after having seen all the alternatives, it knows how large the jump table will be. And that can be done only, can only be seen after, at the end. So therefore, that is the reason why, at least traditionally, it was put at the end. But this is kind of, since modern compilers are no longer one-pass compilers, but traverse the code multiple times, they could put it anywhere. And in particular, they could decide not to put that table in the code at all. They could consider it as, and not consider the table as a table of instructions, but you could also make it a table of addresses, just storing the addresses, and then put it into a data section. And then have just an indirect jump, so that the jump is then taking the value from that particular data table and then jump through that. Yeah, that would be another alternative. Then it would not spoil the code, this table. So there are various options where to place this table and how to implement that table. And it is not a kind of a cut in marble that you must do it in this way. Okay? Okay, so that finishes this section on the switch statement. And again, so here is a little bit of things which one also must, in which way one could use this, could kind of generalize that scheme which I have shown you to slightly more general switch statements, e.g., for example, by if it is a fixed interval which is almost dense and but does not start at zero, and so then you could use essentially the same code generation thing. And if it is very sparse, as I said before, use a hash table, and that's the best what you can do. Now let us leave this kind of area where we just play around with control structures and re-examine the concept of a variable. So far, our programming fragment of a programming language was very simple in that we had only just plain variables, and as Stefan perhaps has explained, it's all int variables here. So it's even simpler. So there is nothing really what happens. All these variables have the same size. And still, we did not speak about where these... So variables are not... do not arrive in our program from heaven or so, but they are kind of they are declared, so they enter at some point in time in program execution into the virtual machine and stay there for some time and then are discarded again. So for that we need kind of a memory management. And in particular, we need to know how much space we would like to allocate and where do we allocate our variables. And the idea, what we always had is, so far is an address environment for variables, which assigns an address to a variable, an address in the stack. So that was what we had so far. This was this row of X giving the address of X. And if the variable is an int variable or of some other basic type, then this will all the values to be stored in that variable will all have essentially the same size. And according to our simplified model, this means that they all will occupy one storage cell. So this is not completely true in practice, where you, in modern architectures, you might have a 64-bit machine, then you have things of various sizes. So you could have integers of a byte, of 2 byte, of 4 byte, or of 8 byte. And in that sense, they could occupy multiple, and address directly addressable could be also, could every byte could be addressable. And then a variable may occupy more than one memory cell, and this means we would have to take into account the sizes of these variables explicitly. Now here we simplify our life in that we say, all of them are the same size, but we kind of, that is only a simplification on the base level, as soon as we go to composite data types, then again, we will have seriously to think about what is the size of a variable, and what is the address of a variable, and that we come to in a minute. Okay. So, but now for that in this that simplified setting where everything has the same size, we may say It has, so it's a bit late. Are you sure that you can still follow? Okay. Assume that we have a sequence of variable declarations, and then the question is, how do we assign to these variables addresses? And if all these variables are have size 1, and we start with giving them addresses starting at 1, then this means they get the ith variable receives address I. So that's kind of the natural way how to deal with that. There's only one minor point which I may already now mention, but which will be later and later see in greater detail. So these are variables. In some sense, it is not typically variable. So there are various kinds of variables. So there are global variables, and there are variables which are local inside procedures or functions. Those variables inside functions, we cannot give in this fixed addresses like in this way. Why? So can we give the first, say we have a procedure executing this sequence of declaration of local variables, could we give the variable x1 the address 1? So we could, but what were the consequences? So, yes, if the function is called several times, maybe if it is recursive even, it will always write into this single memory cell with address 1, although the different calls of the procedure or of the function must be kept separate. So this is kind of a problem. So therefore, in this scheme of assigning addresses to variables works perfectly fine only if these are global declarations which occur once and for all in the program. Okay? So here we consider the case of global variables. As soon as we have local variables, we kind of have to think how to deal with it. And here I already will mention how we deal with it. So as soon as we have also local variables, then we kind of generalize the notion of a variable, of an address assignment, kind of to a relative address assignment. But I will drop this word relative always. So that means that the address in this address assignment is no longer a fixed address, but the address relative to a particular point in the stack. Yeah, so that means now there could be the address 1 is now a relative address 1. And if the points with respect to which I count 1, if these points are different, then 1 could mean different things. Yeah, so that I could have the same function f 20 times in my stack, and relative to the start point to each of these function calls, I could have in place 1 a variable x1. Yeah, and then I have different copies of the same variable. Okay? So therefore, if I have here in brackets this relative. So absolute address environment is only possible for global variables. Otherwise, it is a relative address environment. Okay? Okay. Now, that was the case when variables are of basic type and have all the same size. Now, what happens if it's a composite variable? So what kind of composite variables are around? So one possibility of constructing composite variables is to construct arrays. So without arrays, you can't do very much. So arrays, what is it? So here is it's a kind of a little bit contrived notation. So no C programmer would write it in that way. It would kind of always use this kind of weird wrap around of the type around the variable, which is crazy in some sense, and it sounds looks to me very old-fashioned. But so if you have so what is it? So that means so in some sense it is just if it's here it is this array of consists of 11 int. Variables, if you like, which are kind of put together to form the array. So this means the overall. Now we have to decide on a memory layout for this array. And we can do it in such a way. Well, we first put the A0 on top of the stack, then we put in the next free address, then we put the A1 and then the A2 and so on until A10. Okay. Now, what is then the what should then be the what should then be the row of the A? And the row of A is then simply, if you like, a pointer to the bottommost to the first. Well, it's always a little bit mind-boggling. The first element is always the zeros element. So we'll say the zeros element of the array. So that is kind of this address is the same as the address of this element is the same as the address of the array. Okay? So that means, now in order to do, so for one array, for one variable which is so composite, we now know what to do. We simply take the next free address and give it to this variable. But now what happens if there's another variable which has to be put next? So it should not overlap, so it must have the next free address. So for that I need a notion of the size of how much size a particular type requires. And that size is kind of, well, this is a function which is provided by the which we have to provide, and this is a kind of is computed recursively over the type. So if t is a basic type. Then it should be 1. So here, this is our calculation. Clearly here, this 1 you should replace with the various forms of basic values and all their sizes. And then what happens if you have now an array of a particular size k? Well, that means that you have to... this formula, or at least our compiler then guarantees that the size of the array is exactly k times the size of the member type. Okay, so that's the obvious formula which you would have here, and here we do not. Our goal is not to have something extremely complicated, but to mirror the reality as natural way as possible. Okay, and now this tells us how we deal then if we have now a sequence of variable declarations. How do we proceed now? Well, we give the first free address to the x1, and then once we have already computed the address for xi minus 1, and we know the size of the type of xi minus 1, then we add these two, and this gives us the next free address, which we then assign to the xi. Yeah, and by that, we successively traverse the list of declarations and provide each variable therein with a free address. Okay? And this formula, and as soon as we have more kinds of composite types, then we simply extend our formula for size of, and that's it. And then the same scheme for constructing the address environment will work. Okay? So, but before we proceed to other forms of composite variables, let us first take a slightly closer look of what other challenges are encountered as soon as we have arrays around. So the first thing, so let us consider we have a declaration of some array A of element type T with C elements. And now, so, okay, so this array, we want to access the elements in the array. So how can we do it? So this means the programmer may write something like that, A of I. And that means that here suddenly the element in memory, which is meant here, is no longer so easy, can no longer be determined at compile time, because we don't know the I. And therefore, we also don't know what A of I is. So we cannot make a direct memory look up at some particular place to get that value. Instead, we have to compute first the address which this A of I refers to, and then we are able to retrieve the value therein. Okay? So what do we have to compute? Well, the address which is meant here is, you take the start address of A, and then you have, now what have you do? You have first to evaluate the I. So this is this one. And then you have to not just add the I to the row of A, but you have to scale the I with the size of the elements of the array, and that gives you the step width, if you like, with which you have to step through the array to arrive at the right element. So here is kind of what I have, what we from that consideration deduce if you want to determine the L value of A of E in an address environment row. So what would we have to do? So the first thing is we load the start address of the array. This is just this load constant row of A. So this is a number. Then we have to evaluate the E. So that means we generate code to evaluate the E. And this means the R value of E. Then we have to multiply this, scale that with the size of the elements in the array. So the type of the elements of the array we know. So therefore the size of this type we also know and can compute at compile time. So therefore this is a constant which we just load. This is a single instruction. So then we do the multiplication to do the scaling. And then we add these two values, and then we have arrived at the L value of A of E. Okay? Please speak again. What?
Why do we use T I minus 1 in the formula in our slide?
Here?
Oh, yeah. I didn't understand.
Do you know?
The general formula.
You have the base address of the previous. So you add the size of the previous. Then you get the address of the next. So that's why you address of xi, this is the address of xi minus 1, does the size of xi minus 1, would it occupy that much space after the address of xi minus 1?
So sorry. So this is compile time calculation. This is nothing at runtime. For the compiler kind of determines once the size of each type, and then it adds it. That's it. So this is an array. The i1 is an array, the i2, the x1 is an array, the x2 is a struct, the x3 is an int, the x, and so on. And for each of them it determines how large, how much space it occupies, and adds it, and then it proceeds to the next variable. So you can't avoid to look at the types and to compute the sizes of the types. You will do it once, you will store it in an array, so that for each variable you have all the information about it, whatever is necessary. But here I simply say, give me the size of the type. Yeah? So that's clearly so that if you, before you let your code generator run, you calculate all the information which you have, which you can get out of the front end. And that means you provide for all the variables, the places where they are declared, the types which they have, the sizes which they have, and so on. And therefore here also at that particular point you do not kind of calculate now, I start calculating the type at not, and in particular not at runtime. You look it up. But here I wrote it there that you see what is, what kind of number you use here. And you can do optimizations here. I don't know what somebody, I'm not so sure what, there was an other which are acoustically or the English, or my ears are not so, I could not really understand what the other question here was or the other complaint about this scheme. So there is a kind of point here if you have a kind of an array of basic, of things which have all the same size one, then why do the scaling? That's kind of a stupid thing then. But on the other hand, in the real world, things have not size 1, but size perhaps 4 or 8. So you have to do the scaling. Okay. Now, slightly more generally, it is not so that it's only that that array, that this indexing can be applied to an array variable. It could also be an expression of type array, because you might have, for example, to dereference a pointer and by that arrive at an array, or you have some other thing which evaluates to an array and then you apply the dereferencing. Yeah. So in general you have this form here where it is an expression which is indexed by another expression. And if you, what do you do if you want to do, to compute the L value of this beast? And there the idea is, at least the idea in C, that you compute the R value of the E1, and then the R value of the E2, then you scale the R2, the value computed by E2 with the size of the type. This type is is still statically determined. This is the type of the elements of of E1, which you have can determine at at compile time, and then you add. So this means, in essence, this, and that is kind of the weird thing, this is perhaps a little bit different from what you might have expected. In both cases, you determine the R value. And this, the reason for that is that this indexing can also, can in particular be applied to pointers. And for pointers, if E is a pointer, you want to determine the R value of it, because that gives you the address. And then you can do the indexing, and that means you add something to the address. Yeah, this is for pointer arithmetic. And that means there is this weird thing that in C, it is the same whether you write 2 index A or A index 2 or A plus 2. It is all just addition. It is all just addition. Yeah, and now what is what is determined on the basis of types. One thing of in this addition must be an int, and the other one must be a pointer or an array. And then C or the compiler knows how to arrange the thing. We would I would not advise you to use these other weird forms, but I would advise you always to use the proper form, but it's just a side remark, and that the reason is that C is an old language. I don't know what the designers had in mind. I think it was a little bit to confuse programmers. Okay? But that has the weird effect that the R value of an array is its start address. And how can that be? So the R value is in some sense the equal to the L value if it is an array. Yeah? So that is the way how we can formulate it. If E is an array and I want to determine the R value, then this is the same as the L value. Or put it differently, R value is, I have a variable, give me the content. But this is not the case for arrays. If I give me the R value of the array, then I only get an address. And that is, in some sense, you may say, "Who? This is weird." But that is, in some sense, deliberate, because it says, if you want to pass, the C programmers say, if you want to pass an array as an argument, you better pass the only the address. And that is what happens. Yeah? Okay?
The value of the array is the address, and for example...
The R value of an array is the address.
Yeah, so for that array, I want to know the first value of the, so it's a zero, and in that case, I mean, from that scheme, like code R would be the address of the array, code R E2 would be zero, then load C doesn't matter because multiplication is zero, and add zero, so it would then turn out to be the address of the array again?
Yes.
Okay.
The L value of the first element in the, of the zeros element in the array is the same as the address of the array. Because the zeros element is at the same, is at the same memory cell. So that's, but they have different types.
Yeah.
And that makes the difference. And that makes the difference, because then the R value of that piece, because it has a different type, is the content. And therefore, these types in C matter a lot, in particular for these arrays. Without types, you are lost. Okay? Now, what is your question?
Yeah, like, why does it print? Is a string, it doesn't take, like, only one shot of the string, but more.
So, the implementation is, so do you ask me about the functionality of the standard library?
Yeah.
So, they made it a clever job, that I can tell you, so that it works. But this doesn't contradict the notion that the R value of an array is an address. So perhaps a little bit, I guess, much less surprising than arrays are structures. And structures, I think they came into being, I think they were invented in the programming language COBOL, so they are to be part of the oldest programming languages in the world. And the idea is you want to put things of different types into a compound structure. And that is the idea of these structures. And so here I'm not so sure whether I think this simplification which I just here now introduce is not so great, but maybe in later versions of the lecture I also will skip it again. So structures have components, and these components again are named. So you select the components of a struct by names, and so we have to maintain the names. And a minor simplification might be that we maintain these names also in our address environment. So clearly, if it's in our address environment and you have two kinds of structs and they share some component names, then we would be doomed, because then we have a conflict. So therefore, for simplicity, we might simply assume that the names of structure component are unique to the structs. This is not the case in C, and it only simplifies our handling. Otherwise, here I have written what one would have to do in reality is that for each type of for each structure type, we would have to maintain a separate environment with all the containing the names for the components. Yeah, but that I kind of found. So we have a two-level environment for a two-level address environment, and I found that a little bit too contrived, and therefore it's only one with this extra. With this unrealistic extra restriction. Okay. So now let us see what special things might occur here. So the first thing is, so here is, assume that we have such a declaration, such a of a variable x as part of our declaration list. So now the data so let me see, so here, so this means we need two memory cells, one memory cell corresponding to the A, one memory cell corresponding to the B. And now the X, what is the X? So for the X, we have the the address of a compound or composite data value. The design choice which we have taken is that the X would point to the first of the memory cells of that for that composite data value, and that means that the address of X would be the same as the address of the A component, the first component of X. So X and X, the L value of X and the L value of X dot A is the same. The only difference is that both X and X dot A differ in their types. And sometimes, that's a strange thing, sometimes C programmers, if we, instead of selecting the first component of a struct, they cast the L value of the struct to the type of the first component. Because it's the same address. But that is again one weird style of C programming, which is not, which I would not like to recommend. But it's the it exploits this fact that X and the first component of X have the same address. Okay. Okay, so then all the components in the struct. Now, what are the, for the A and the B? We can assign also relative addresses, and namely relative addresses to the beginning of the struct. So the relative address of A to the beginning of the struct is zero because it's the first component, and B is then it's the second component, and therefore it receives relative address 1, because we have to add the size of the first component to 0, giving in this case 1. So in general, if we have a struct of that form, then the size of that struct is just the sum of the sizes of the components of that struct. And the first, if the selectors are C1 to CK, then C1 receives relative address 0, and CI receives the relative address which is obtained by taking the relative address for CI minus 1 and adding the size of that component, the size of the type of that component. And again, this calculation must not be done at, or will not be done at compile time, at runtime, but at compile time. And that means at compile time, the compiler knows the sizes of these types T1 to TK and has already determined their sizes, and then just looks up these sizes and writes down these relative addresses. Okay. Now we, if we have such an expression E of which whose type is such a struct, then we might wonder what is the L value of the C's component of that value. So how do we determine it? Well, the idea is clear. So we first have to go to the E, so we have to determine the L value of the E, and then we have to do to proceed to the C's C's component of the struct, and that means we have to look up the relative address of the relative address of C in the address environment. This is a constant. And this constant we have simply to add to the L value of E. And this gives us that. Okay? And now it's time for a little bit of an example. So here we have one nice declaration of a variable. So X is a struct with components A and B, and A and B have then relative addresses 0 and 1, which we have computed and stored in our address environment. And X, for some reason, because it's in some weird context, has address 13. And if we then want to determine what is X dot B, that means we have to, according to our systematic way of generating code for such composite expressions, is we first have to determine the L value of X. Now the L value of X is, look up the X is a variable, therefore look up the value in the address environment. Therefore it is a load constant C, load constant 13. Then we load the offset for the selector B, and then we add, and that's it. Okay. So in that sense, structs are much simpler than arrays. So everything is there. That's an interesting thing. If you want to pass an array really by value, what can you do? You wrap it into a struct and then pass the struct by value. That is the way how you kind of can pass in C an array if you really like to pass an array by value. You can do it in this way. So the things become really interesting in C if you if there are pointers. So without pointers, C is essentially nothing. So now, what are pointers good for? So pointers, in some sense, well, you all know, you all have used pointers in this or that form. But on the other hand, but I may just for my information, who's a C programmer here? Who is a Java programmer? So do Java programmers use pointers? No, what do you use? Nothing? You have something similar. What do you have?
Well, they are called references. Basically, they're probably not so different from pointers themselves, but you can't use any pointer arithmetics in Java.
You cannot use pointer arithmetic. That is what you are saying. That's true. But in some sense, in Java, one could think of that it is not, you do not have explicit pointers. That is exactly what you say. But you have something similar because every object, in some sense, could be considered as a struct in the heap. And on the stack, you have a pointer going to that particular object. And also arrays are not on the stack, but they are always on the heap, and what you have on the stack is the pointer to it. And when you pass an array by value in Java, you only pass the reference to the heap allocated array. So in that sense, it has a quite similar effect as passing arrays by value in C, only that everything is in Java in the heap and not on the stack, or at least conceptually. And that means, yeah, so in that sense, there is also something, but in some sense, it is a little bit under the scene, so Java programmers usually do not worry very much about these distinction between an object as a data as a memory section in the heap and objects as a reference on the stack to such a memory section. And this is on the downside, so the programmer is not so much aware of it, but on the other hand, he cannot manipulate so much with it, and therefore Java offers something which is very convenient, and many of us are very enthusiastic about it, which is garbage collection. So Java, you typically do not have to care about the lifetime of objects. As soon as objects are no longer used, we kind of assume that the garbage collector will take care of it and collect it, which is mostly the case, but sometimes it is not. That is another story. But in usual applications, this works extremely fine, and it makes programming life of a programmer quite easy. At least those people who know C programming or C++ programming and Java programming might agree in that. But on the other hand, C programmers and C++ programmers are extremely proud how cleverly they reuse their objects and how few copying they do and how they use constructors and destructors and how proud they are to rule the memory. But this is also kind of it's not so nice also. And it's very error-prone. You can make a lot of mistakes. And if you don't collect your garbage, then it may happen that you run out of memory quite quickly. So it's much more complicated. So And so now our virtual machine, so we are in a C world, so we cannot rely on garbage collection for the moment. So we somehow therefore have to come up with memory management, which deals with dynamically allocated data, with data which is accessed only by pointers, and which is and what is the particular thing with this dynamically allocated data? So it somehow does not follow the FIFO first in the LIFO principle of which we have for on the call stack. It's not so that the object or the data structure which is allocated the latest will go out of existence for the first. So it's not so. So therefore, it could be that things which are already have lived very long may suddenly die, while things which are very young suddenly may start to live forever. So we therefore have no possibility to maintain dynamically allocated data within our stack. So we therefore have to provide a new kind of a new type of memory, which we call the heap. And now this is a data structure which is again unbounded, because we do not know in advance how many elements will be put onto the heap. And therefore, we have to kind of divide our store into such a way that both the stack, which is in principle an unbounded data structure, as the heap can survive without interfering without interfering at all, or at least with interfering only as little as possible. And how can that be done? So that one classical way how to maintain two possibly very large data structures in the same contiguous memory is to kind of split the memory conceptually into two parts, but have not a fixed separation between the two parts, but something which may be kind of going either to this side or to that side, and so kind of may change, so the border may change. And so here in this case, we signify a possible limit between the one data structure and the other by means of this, by means of one particular pointer which kind of keeps track of this position. This is the EP or extreme pointer. This should be the last position where the stack in the foreseeable future will go to. And then if we know that the stack will go only to the EP, then the rest of our memory is all free for the heap. And as long as the heap does not go beyond the EP pointer, everything is fine. Okay? So that is this EP pointer. So the heap, therefore, may only go up to that position. Okay? And then the stack may only go to the EP. So that's kind of the basic idea of this new data structure and how this new data structure is arranged within the same memory space. There is perhaps one more side remark. So this construction which I present you here is kind of a standalone construction which you always can apply if you have operating system support. You can also use different kinds of organizations. For example, if the operating system provides you with kind of segments or so, which have empty intersections, so you could provide one segment for your stack and another segment for your heap, and that's it. And let the operating system take care that they do not interfere. So that's another way. In that sense, in this case, you would kind of save this EP pointer. So here we do not rely on such operating system support, so therefore we have it. Another thing here is, at some point we will have to allocate new things in the heap. How can we do that? So here the idea is that we maintain another pointer, which we have not yet had before, which it did not have before. This is this new pointer. This new pointer always points to the last occupied memory cell in the heap. Yeah, that means whenever we allocate a new element on the heap, we would place it here, and we would decrement the new pointer there, and then we can return the new pointer on the stack to give us the first address of the newly allocated data element in the heap. Okay? So therefore, the new pointer points to the last allocated memory cell on the heap, like the stack pointer, the last one on the top on the stack. Okay? So that's kind of the convention which we have. And now can start to think of what we can make out of it. The first thing is, since these two data structures grow in direction of each other, there could be a collision. And the collision, there are various kinds of collisions. Some of these collisions actually can be handled inside of C itself. So which kind of collision can be handled inside C itself? So what happens if the stack grows into the heap? Because you do a function call and then there's no longer enough stack space. Yeah, but that's true, but can that be handled? No, that cannot be handled. What happens if the heap what happens if we do a malloc, also there is not enough heap space anymore? Will there also be a stack overflow? No. This is the thing which we can handle inside of C, because then the malloc returns null, and then the programmer may decide what he does. And actually he should deal with this case. I think many programmers simply ignore the case because they assume there's always sufficiently memory available. But in principle, you have to take care what happens if there's no memory. And that's the case which you can handle inside C. Okay. So now what can we do with pointers and with pointer values? So the first thing is we can set a pointer. We can set a pointer to a memory cell. That's the first thing. And the other thing is, once we have a pointer, we can dereference it, and by that access the value inside the memory cell the pointer points to. Yeah. And now and we will look at both of these things. The first thing is, how can we set a pointer to a value? And there are two ways how to do that. The first thing is we call a library function, which is which is called malloc. And this malloc thing will return us with a pointer to a memory, to some portion of memory inside the heap, or it may return null. So that's the other thing, and this is one way. And the other way how to obtain a pointer to a value is by means of the address operator, and that we will also discuss. And that means in this case, the variable or the data is already there, if you like, and you only kind of get hold of the L value of this beast. So that is for the address operator. But for today, I guess it's enough. Thank you very much for your attention. And tomorrow we again meet at 10:15. That was the decision. All right? Thank you.